Comedian Robin Williams was so impressed with Margot Gomez that he called her the lesbian Lenny Bruce. It wasn't long after that Hollywood cast her alongside Queen Latifah as a pair of scientists who dive deep into the ocean to discover a buried alien spaceship in the film Sphere.
The movie was released a year after comedian Ellen DeGeneres came out as gay, and at the time, it seemed Hollywood was ready to cast strong women in comfortable shoes into action film roles.
Today, comedian, performance artist, lesbian icon, and sci-fi action movie star Margot Gomez joins us to look at her Sphere co-star Queen Latifah finally coming out 23 years after sharing with her the silver screen.
Listen as we take a look at how onstage performance and online media are morphing together into an unrecognizable blob, and how Margot Gomez is turning to her online streaming events to reconnect with the world and fight the COVID blues.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is celebrating 3,000 delicious podcast episodes by looking back at our show with some of our most fabulous guests. While we're hitting a major milestone in internet history by the sheer number of podcasts we created over the past 16 years, we aren't sitting back and taking it easy.
We've got a lot of yummy dishes waiting to be served. New podcasts, new Cooking with Drag Queen episodes, and a whole new live streaming show and contest. So we need your help to make it happen. Help us celebrate, create the streaming show, and keep this podcast Feast of Fun going strong into the future by visiting GoFundMe.com/FeastOfFun3000 and pledge your support today.
Thank you.
Dinner's ready.
Gomez Studios, who is this?
Is this Margot Gomez?
This is she or they.
They. Hi, Margot. This is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun.
Oh, what? Did I win something? What did I win?
You won my friendship.
Oh.
And I have your friendship.
And eternal admiration.
Well, we're very rich in the fact that we love each other. And I am a big fan of yours, but way back from the 90s.
I've coveted your friendship as your friendships. I've coveted that. Yes, I was a fan before we ever met, and have admired your, I hate that term pioneering, but trailblazing, but your imagination and innovation in podcasting. Yay.
Well, the thing I adore about you, Margot Gomez, I was going to call you Latina Gomez.
I've been saying in my head, Margot Gomez, like Margot Channing.
Margot Channing.
Oh, no, no, let's not start people on the Margot. My whole career has just been to train people to say Marga and not Margot. But I just thought of my hip hop name.
What's that?
Queen Latina.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, so in the early 90s, you became a household name for being this fierce, funny, queer Puerto Rican performance artist and unapologetically talking about your lesbianism, your heritage, in these wonderful shows that you performed all across the United States, but also especially in New York City. And that was at a time when we didn't have representation on television and films. And so, you know.
Yeah, that was a good time for me.
It was a good.
I cornered the market.
And the thing about it is, you know, your life and your career very much takes a similar path to ours, but also in the way that we see LGBTQ people represented and where they're represented and where they're performing, you know, and in the 1995 film Batman Forever, you had a film role. Your first film role was playing a journalist asking people, is this film full of shit or not?
It was a classic, though. That's the Val Kilmer one.
That's the Val Kilmer
with Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
Poor Val Kilmer.
Why do you say poor Val Kilmer?
I guess he's sort of down and out. I don't know. I was listening to my friend's podcast, and they were just talking about how there's this documentary about Val Kilmer, and apparently he went in for plastic surgery, which is something I never expected from him, because he's so very climate change conscious, and I don't know. I just didn't think he was going to get into looks, but yeah.
Well, there's a lot of Hollywood hunks and movie stars that have gone through changes in their lives, and then they're put in a position to have to explain why they don't look the way they did 20 years ago. What is the mummy, Brendan Fraser? He had a bunch of like medical problems because he did his own stunts in the mummy films, and he suffered profoundly medically because of it, and it kind of just like torpedoed his film career.
Yeah, he was a lot of pain.
I didn't know that, but good way to get drugs, though.
Watch some Oxycontin, do your own stunts. Yeah.
And so maybe like...
That's what I tell people. Oh, I did a lot of stunts.
What I wanted to start off talking about with you today is, what is it that made you want to get into show business? Because your father was a showbiz tycoon. As a young, you know, Latinx lesbian living in New York City, moving to San Francisco, and you know, like, what was the driving force for you in the early 90s?
Pussy.
So you knew if you got up on stage that you'd just become like this pussy magnet?
Yeah, absolutely. I, of course, inherited my love of performing and storytelling from both my parents. Both my parents were in show business.
What did your father do?
My father was a hyphenate. He was a comedian, and then sort of parlayed that into being a producer, an impresario. I think really, if there was one thing that he was notable for, it was creating these variety shows in New York in the 50s and 60s. And he came as just a scruffy, skinny, penniless guy to New York. And there was a Latino variety scene happening. And nobody would give him a break. And he just jumped on stage one night and just started telling jokes on the mic. And that was it. So that's what he did. He was the MC of the shows and he told jokes. But I think he was really a hustler. He created commercials and shows for Spanish radio, did a little Spanish TV.
And that's Willie Chevalier.
That was his stage name. Okay. And the show that I did when I had this wonderful week in Chicago at the Teatro Urbano, and got to see you both in person, in persona, was a show called Latin Standards. And I did that in Chicago. And it was about my father's songwriting hustle. When the live entertainment began to change because the economy was rough and the Latino community started to splinter, my father got into writing songs. And he knew so many musical groups. And he would just kind of hum a melody and he'd write the lyrics, and then he'd get a trio to record it. So that's what that play was sort of really focused on.
And your mother is the exotic dancer Margarita Estremera. Was she a burlesque dancer?
I don't think the term burlesque was ever really used. It was more she was an exotic dancer.
Is there a difference?
Well, burlesque, I mean, right now, you know, burlesque has this resurgence. It's, you know, there's a formula to it. There's a tease, there's costumes, there's the style of music. My mom just was, she started out as an Afro-Cuban dancer. I mean, she was a showgirl and a dancer. She did work with Hope Diamond, who was a famous burlesque act. But that, you know, it just has its own roots. You know, it's more like in variety shows, there'd be the comedian and there'd be the acts. And my mom was more of a nightclub entertainer. Like when she started in New York, she was an Afro-Cuban dancer, mambo dancer. And then my father booked her for his shows and they started dating and they actually got married. Their marriage wasn't very strong. They stayed together, unfortunately for me, for 12 years. But she decided to make more money as a belly dancer. So then her stage name became Margo the Exotic. She had this...
That's interesting. So kind of a name that you could have used, right? Right. Well, Marga, the you know, truth teller. Now that she's your mother was the exotic.
Yeah. And she had a, you know, she just had a regular, like, you know, one of those agents, one of those New York agents, and he booked her in the clubs. And she worked with comedians who were very famous in the 60s, Alan King, mm-hmm. the guy who was in Car 54. I mean, of course, they're not famous now, but at Al the Lewis. Time, it was kind of a Al Lewis Grandpa was Grandpa Monster. The Munsters, but
Yeah,
but it was Car 54. It was like the little chubby one.
It was Fred Wynn and Al Lewis were the stars of Car 54. So it was somebody else. Or was the guy who went, oh.
That guy, Tootie. He played Tootie. Yes. Yeah. His. But that's not Al Lewis. Al Lewis is a different guy.
Oh my God, Charlotte Ray was in that.
Yeah, so that's kind of, you know, I know we're mincing words, but it's kind of important.
Joe Ross, Officer Gunn.
Joe Ross, yes, very good. You must have a
computer in front
device
of
near you. Yes, a device.
Don't we all?
Magic 8-Ball said it, yes. So, you know.
So what I'm trying to understand is your own motivation to be an artist and performer. Was that something that came from your parents mostly, or was it something that your peers, your friends were doing and you wanted to jump in?
Yes, I had an aptitude for it when I went to college, not too long. I did creative writing. I loved creating stories and worlds and all this. And I really wasn't interested in being a belly dancer or a mambo. And I'm a terrible dancer. So everything was really my father's influence and the way people responded to my father, because he could make them laugh. That was a gift. The way people responded to my mom, I just tried not to pay attention to that. And then...
Why? Was it too like sexual or something? Or
yeah. Oh, my mom was a femme fatale. I mean, my parents would only leave the house at night because they were late sleepers. And so, and in our neighborhood, it was, you know, Latino, and some of the people were just from like, you know, from the hills. They were just country folk, and they thought my parents were vampires. That was the word going around about my parents. And so then finally, when I was, I think, first year in college, I had this girlfriend. She looked like Joni Mitchell. We did a lot of 69ing. I had the lesbian acne. And are you following me?
Yeah,
I didn't know that was a thing.
You know where it falls, the lesbian acne. Yeah, and oops, I hit the mic. And so basically, I didn't come out to my parents. They found out, and I headed to San Francisco. I didn't even know that San Francisco was the gay capital. I just thought that's, you know, that's just freedom, freedom. And I went all the way from New York to San Francisco with my girlfriend. Once I got to San Francisco, it was the late 70s and 80s, and there was this counterculture performance scene. So the long way to answer that question is I had an appreciation of performance. I didn't think it was going to happen for me until I moved to San Francisco, because before that, I realized, I can't speak Spanish, so Spanish showbiz is out. And mainstream showbiz, I don't see anybody who looks like me. But then I went to San Francisco, and it was all queer people, people of color, performing, and the audiences were there for us. And so I began developing the voice, that not the singing voice, but you know who I am as a performer.
Robin Williams was a fan of yours. He described you as a lesbian Lenny Bruce.
I miss him so much. I mean, we weren't like hanging out all the time, but I got on his radar because we were both doing this big benefit at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And it was a benefit for, I think it was for the Celluloid Closet. You know, it was a great film, and this was a fundraiser. And Robin and Lily Tomlin and Lipsinka and Harvey Fierstein were in this benefit.
What a lineup.
Yes. And me.
Damn.
And the lesbian chorus.
Damn.
And there was some sort of incident where I think Harvey made a joke and the lesbian chorus got mad.
And, oh, man. And that was I would not want a chorus of lesbians mad at me.
Yeah, they all sing in unison.
It's raining men.
What did he say that got them so upset?
I don't remember. You know, just probably, you know, just one of those hacky jokes about lesbians. You may have heard them or told them. But anyway, there was tension, and then
I'm just
it was
kidding.
Time.
Please forgive me.
And then, he was like, "Oh, whoops!" And now Marga Gomez. and I went on stage, and this was kind of make it or break it for the night, and. This was in the 90s. I don't remember what the joke was, but whatever it was, Robin was in the wings and he saw me tell a joke to the audience and it diffused the situation, got a big laugh. And then we were back on the happy train.
Wow.
And after that, he found me backstage and told me how much he just loved what I did. And then he and his wife at the time invited me to perform on Comic Relief, HBO's Comic Relief. And right. I think that was 1995.
I saw that. Yeah.
Oh God, I was so nervous. This is what I would tell people who are starting out is do not look at the people giving you side eye. So I performed it. I forget what the venue was.
Well, Comic Relief, for people not familiar, was sort of like the USA for Africa of comedians. And it was a televised...
USA for Africa was also a long time ago. I think you have to come
well,
up with something.
Well, it was a collection. It was a celebration of the who's who of the entertainment industry getting together to raise funds for our charity. USA for Africa was all the pop stars singing, "We are the world, we are the children." In this case, Comic Relief was Whoopi Goldberg, Billy Crystal, and Robin Williams gathering their friends in comedy to do performances on television to raise funds for the homeless.
Well, you know, for a TV taping, and I've done a few of these, and I don't enjoy them because it's so lit. It's lit for a TV production, so people are sitting there, and unlike at a club where you know it's dark and people are having cocktails and they're actually having fun, this is a very awkward situation. I mean, they're laughing, but you know everything is sweetened, and they're laughing, you know, when they're big stars. But it's not a generous audience, and I went up there and. I think I did one or two references to being a lesbian. And for some reason there were probably 500 people who were enjoying it. And then there was just one terrible, mean, old white man. It seems like he had his own table there and he's just looking at me with a big sourpuss. And I couldn't look away from him for my whole little 3 minutes. I could not look, you know, I've seen it since then and. You know, it's not, I don't look freaked out, but inside I was dying 1,000 deaths.
How did you end the set? Do you remember the last joke you did?
Yes, I do. I think it was cut. I did an act out and it was one of my favorite things to perform. And it was, but it was a bit, you know, and they want jokes. That was the thing about me. I was more of a storyteller and I have these bits. So this was my favorite bit. It was, The Diary of Anaïs Nin at Disneyland. And so, you know, it takes...
Who's Anaïs Nin?
Anaïs Nin was at USA for Africa. She was... No. Anaïs Nin was a writer. That's right, Delta of Venus. And there was a movie that was pretty great called Henry in June. And the movie had opened around that time. But she was a writer of... erotica and journals and all kinds of things, but she became very famous, especially with the lesbian community and the women's literature fans for her writing and her erotica. And then but her diaries were also very famous and there were a lot of diaries that were lost and all this. So I had this bit, The Lost Diary of Anaïs Nin that I basically wrote when I had gone to Disneyland with my girlfriend at the time. And I had this dream where I saw it all, this affair with Anaïs Nin and Minnie Mouse. And it's really cute and it's really fun. And I do this terrible French accent. But anyway, for some reason, I thought everybody loves this. I'm going to close with it. And it was wrong. It was wrong. And then I said it real fast because I knew my time was they were about to, you know, cut my set.
Yeah.
But that was my close. And then whatever they edited to, I don't remember what that was.
That's fascinating.
That is a very 90s time capsule there too, because I feel like in the 80s and 90s, every girl I knew was reading Anais Nin, especially like Delta of Venus. I actually read it too, and it's, you know, it gets you horny.
would you like to hear it?
Sure.
Would you like me to do it for you?
Yeah.
You can always cut this, right?
We'll probably edit it out. We will be editing it out.
That's no, okay. You could. I understand.
Just kidding.
I understand HBO. HBO. I fucking understand. Okay. I'll just do it for you now.
Okay.
All right. Let's see if I even remember it, because I usually have to rehearse it after. Me. I set this up by saying, "Well, you all know Anais Nin except Fausto." And you know that she wrote all these diaries and some of them were lost. I have one of them I found on the back of the bus. I'm going to turn to any entry. Oh, this one's good. Disneyland, 1958. While waiting online for the Matterhorn, I had the feeling that I was being watched. I turned in the direction of the intensity, but all I saw was someone selling pretzels and the usual Disneyland characters, Goofy, Chip, and Dale, the two mice, Minnie. At one point, I thought that I saw Minnie shoot me a look. It seemed to be a challenge, a dare, if you will. I told myself, but it is nothing. I am being too disturbed. And I continued my approach to the roller coaster.
Yes, Slay Queen. You know, I could listen to you say anything in that French accent.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's safe. I won't be canceled. I don't think I'll be canceled.
I think you just lost all your French fans and the Quebecians too.
Oh no, I love Quebec.
Well, you need to apologize.
We can go to Canada now. They're just on Monday. I think starting on Monday, you can go to
really?
Canada.
Really? Let's get in the car and go.
The borders are open.
I love Canada.
I don't know if you have to show proof of vaccination or not, but.
Margo, where were you when Ellen DeGeneres came out? I don't want to make it sound like it was a catastrophe.
I was between her legs.
You were between her legs.
I was between her legs.
Really?
Yeah, I said, I think it'd be a good idea if we finally talked about this.
Because it was a
You're
big deal.
You're going to be my last white woman, Ellen. Please make it count.
All right. No, but it was a big deal. You know, it was a profound shift in... Because she was, you know, had a sitcom, Ellen, where sort of they made it about her awkwardness in dating. And then for some reason, Ellen DeGeneres said, you know, I'm going to come out of the closet. I'm sick of being in the closet. She gave no fucks. The networks and her writers went back and forth. And she came out publicly on Time Magazine. Yep, I'm gay. Had her character come out. And she went on Oprah. And the audience was like, you suck. You're a terrible person. Fuck you. You're canceled. And Ellen didn't really work for quite some time after that. And it was doing the daytime talk show was kind of like some people saw it as a desperate grasp at keeping a entertainment career going. And, you know, then she had this enormous success. But Ellen DeGeneres today, she says, you know, her true love has always been performing in front of audiences and not interviewing other people, you know. And you know, you can kind of really see that when she did her Netflix special, how much she sort of enjoyed herself. And I'm wondering, like, you know, in terms of, you know, somebody who was there in the thick of it all, you know, and there was so much, you know,
between her legs. Between her legs.
Like, how did
pretty,
that
for a blonde? She's pretty hairy.
Did it impact you? Did it affect you in any way?
Were you like, wow, she came out?
Okay. I have,
or I'm going to do all. A little,
okay. I'm going to answer that. It's I do have an answer for it. It's quite interesting, my answer. But I have to change chairs because this chair is squeaky, and I don't want it to sound like I'm farting. So hang on just a moment. Hold that thought. Put a pin in it. I'm going to just get a good old wooden chair. Hang on.
We're here.
Yeah, it does sound like she's farting.
Yeah.
Where were you when Ellen came out, Mark?
I was living in an apartment in Roscoe Village at the time, here in Chicago.
I was in the cafeteria of my school.
And I remember, I probably heard it on television or something, and then, I would have seen the People magazine, right, cover?
Yeah.
Or
was it Time magazine? Time magazine.
Yep, I'm gay.
People was Lance Bass.
Okay, I'm back. I'm back. Oh. So here is the... here is the answer. Can I go back before she came out? Because Ellen really actually got started, I believe, in really, really just caught fire in San Francisco in the 80s. So when I was struggling until the queer comedy club opened, but in the mainstream comedy clubs that were opening in San Francisco, which had the comedy boom, which gave us Robin Williams and gave us
Jerry Seinfeld. Paula Poundstone.
No, Jerry Seinfeld. No, did not. No, York, no. Right? I don't think rarely played. No, Jerry was basically based in New York and came up in those clubs, but in San Francisco it was really a lot about Robin Williams and a lot of people who are out there now. But Ellen would go. This is where I would see Ellen at the other cafe in the Hate, and she would show up and she was doing very well. You know, she was in that league with Robin, and yet at the same time, Ellen was, you know, just a big old dyke, you know, big old butch dyke. She was actually larger than she actually was. You know, she was hefty, like the size I am now. And she was dating this woman who was friends with my friends and my girlfriend at the time, Monica. We're still close. So she was kind of in this whole gang, but she was very single minded. She broke up with the girlfriend. I don't know exactly, you know, how that went, but here's a little, I know you're going to cut this, but if I just speak freely, then I worked in a t-shirt store on Castro Street called High Gear. And basically, we sold items for the gay men in the 80s. So it was gym shorts and tank tops and t-shirts and 501s. And so basically I spent a lot of my day folding t-shirts, and one day Ellen and her girlfriend walk in, and the girlfriend, I was eating a Snickers bar at the time. It was a very lax job, and the girlfriend says, "I want some Snickers." And then she and I wound up in the dressing room, and then Ellen DeGeneres was just kind of hanging out, like being, you know, a fool, a cuckold. And then the girlfriend and I were, and anyway, that has nothing to do
with... Wait, you were feeding her a Snickers in the changing room?
She wanted to play a little joke on her girlfriend, I guess. And I said, "Well, come on, let's go in the dressing room." And then, you know, we just didn't do anything. But it was all weird. I'm sorry I brought it up. However, in these comedy clubs, Ellen was doing really well. And throughout the, leading up to when she came out, I was on a TV show with her, a talk show, called People Are Talking. And then I had this other gig with her. They did this show called Comedy Tonight. She was still in the closet, but we were just sort of in the green room together. And then I think she was trying to have me believe that she was bisexual now. And she kept pointing to this guy who was on stage. She goes, I think maybe I'll go for him tonight. It's like, yeah. Okay, oh, wow. Great.
So she was trying to like go back in the closet before your very eyes.
Well, you know, I was such an out lesbian that I think she was trying to hide the trail.
She didn't do a very good job, because I ran into her at Chance's lesbian bar in, I think it was not when she was on Fox's TV show Open House. She played the receptionist,
of a real estate agency.
Yeah.
And I saw her and I was like, oh my God, it's Ellen DeGeneres, you know, because she was at that time a pretty well-known on television comedian. She was, you know, Johnny Carson invited her to the chair, you know, and gave her the chair. you know, so to me, I thought it was really cool that there's this like open or somewhat open, you know, for a lot of people like Rosie and Ellen, they were open socially because people didn't have cell phone and, you know, paparazzi weren't hanging out in gay bars. And so a lot of these queer entertainers were very comfortable in having, you know, dating and sexual lives. And while at the same time on stage and in front of television cameras, they never talked about their experiences as lesbians or gay men.
Back then, it was possible to have open secrets. And even when I had my little fling with LA and I was signed by creative artists, I said, well, you know, I'm not quite sure because I'm a lesbian and how do I, because, you know, creative artist agencies were star makers and they thought they would make money off of me. And I was going in to meetings, you know, sitting at that big board table, getting all the Diet Cokes I wanted. And then I said, well, but, you know, I'm a lesbian. And they said, it's okay. Just don't talk about it. It's very, very much a family. But the thing about Ellen is, oh, and also that. Yeah. So Ellen would just basically do what she wanted because also the media, you know, they all had an arrangement. They all had an agreement. It's, you know, whatever her agency was, it was probably CAA. You know, you wouldn't dare fuck with the agency, right?
Right.
So she could do whatever she wanted. I mean, I saw her at a girl bar in LA, you know, just ogling I guess she was a go-go dancer. And I was going to call her a stripper, but again, these words are very precise. And it's like, wow, like basically like your tongue is hanging down. It's like, you know, and she hadn't come out yet. But up to the point that Ellen came out, I had come out, Kate Clinton had come out, Karen Williams, Suzanne Westenhofer. There's a documentary about us called Laughing Matters by Andrea Meyerson.
Right.
And we actually were doing very well because we were the only ones who were out. You know, and I'm sure I'm leaving some other out comedians.
Don't forget Reno, Suzanne Westenhofer.
She said Suzanne.
Suzanne Westenhofer. Yeah, okay. But Reno, yes, Reno wasn't doing stand up comedy I mean, Reno's brilliant, but she was actually doing more like Eric Bogosian. She was doing solo performance. Uh-huh. But as far as stand up comedy, that's, you know, that's its own genre. Right. And so, when Ellen came out, it wasn't like we went, yay. It was, there's a little bit of resentment because it's like, you know what? You waited a long time. Like, I think Rosie came out first. And Rosie, I was on Rosie's show. She had a stand-up spotlight on VH1.
Right.
And I was booked to be on her show. And I didn't say, you know, and I basically didn't say anything about being gay. I think she and I had some sort of coded discussion about it. And at the time, she had a fiance, Larry Amoros, who's also gay. A lot of people did that. You know, they had the beards, right?
Rosie was with a guy?
He was gay also. They were both, they had this arrangement so they could always, you know, if somebody tried to out them, they go, oh, no, look, I have a fiance here. See? Wow. See that squishy guy? See that butch woman? We're going to get married.
In all my years, this is the first time we've ever heard about Rosie O'Donnell having a gay beard to hide her lesbianism.
Well, you know, Rosie's been awesome.
Yeah.
You know, when I started doing comedy, I didn't start saying I'm a lesbian. I started doing shows for forest rangers and these corporate gigs as a Latina. And it's like, oh, I need to earn this money, and I didn't know exactly how to bridge my lesbianism to these super, super straight kind of conservative audiences. So I did a few years like that. And it took some people longer. I have a lot of cohorts in comedy who are lesbians who they came out after me, and I'm not going to say I didn't resent them, but who am I to cast a stone when, you know, if you do one show in the closet, then you really can't judge other people except for Ellen.
So do you feel like a lot of the lesbian comedians at that time period didn't have the happy reaction that the public did? They were just more like salty about it.
I'm not going to speak for anyone else, but I think the only person who, and she said it in the documentary, and that's why I'm going to repeat it, is suddenly the LGBTQ community forgot about supporting their own, and they supported someone who had come out lately when it was safer to do so. Okay, you could say, oh, this happened on Oprah, but you know, she was rich. She was going to do okay. You know, we basically, there were many of us who started out performing for prides, performing for rallies, performing for AIDS fundraisers. And we were who we were, and we were talking about what was happening to our community. Ellen skipped all that, and that's not who she is. She's not a political comedian anyways, and it's weird when she tries to be one. Rosie's way more political, you know. She got into tussles with, that horrible president we had before. Yeah,
Rosie was right about everything with Trump, though.
A friend of ours had a pinata of Trump, and they're like, they wanted us to hit it and like say something. So I hit it, and I said, "This one's for Rosie."
That's nice.
She warned us way beforehand.
Yes.
So then in 1998, you and Queen Latifah got cast in this sci-fi action adventure film that's basically about lesbians under the sea. Called Sphere.
Sphere. That was its downfall, is that title, for anyone who, you know, has a gap between their teeth. I can't sphere. It's very bad. It's very bad on a podcast.
And you know, I've been trying to find a copy of that film to watch it because I love you and I want to see it. And I cannot, like, they have buried that movie. You can't find it on Amazon. You can't find it anywhere.
Really?
That's weird, because I get residual checks from it at every now. I mean, I think that HBO might still own it. I mean, when it's in rotation with Showtime or HBO, then it's taken off of the those other platforms. But
I'll look again, because so
I have VHS.
Was it strange, or like, you know, because a perennial favorite in lists of closeted celebrities is Queen Latifah. And so, you know, just a month ago in 2021, years and years later, she, when she's receiving a BET Lifetime Achievement Award, she says, I want to thank my fans for supporting every crazy ass thing I've done through the years. Thank you for making Equalizer number one. Ebony, my love. That's her wife.
Ebony.
Rebel, my love, peace, happy pride. And so people were like, she came out, but it's just, she said it so quickly and she didn't be
kinda
like,
that's kind of how Jodie Foster did it too.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, I'm a lesbian, I'm queer. They just go, I want to thank, Sally, who I see I live with, you know, cause we're sleeping together and in a relationship.
We have a Boston marriage.
Yes. That was another one. I didn't quite celebrate that one. I mean, when you're in that position of influence and you come out, it's because the benefit is for people who are in danger, you know? You can help people. You can help people with their families. You can help raise awareness and understanding, you know, for fans who somehow missed it and might be homophobic. So, and yet I still can't judge, but I don't celebrate it. It's like, it was no big deal.
I liked that on social media you posted, you said, you like science too.
It was a scene from The Sphere with you and Queen Latifah.
Oh, yeah. I think that was in response to that horrible, sad administration we had, the anti-science administration. And then I was also sort of doing, there was a Ryan, what's it, Ryan, that actor? And then he was, Ryan there was Reynolds? All these, Ryan Gosling. There were all these memes, Ryan Gosling, and he'd say, hey, girl. So so that was kind of an old one that I made. And Ryan Gosling time, and then I just used this photo. I just took a screen grab from the replay of it.
So the science is referencing lesbianism, isn't it? So it wasn't coded.
It's all science,
It wasn't coded at the time as lesbianism.
You know, I want people to make their own inferences.
Okay. Okay.
It was an ambiguous read.
Yes.
If the shoe fits, if the Birkenstock fits, wear it.
But I'll tell you a fun fact. Sphere was, I think it was obviously my first movie, and I guess it's my last as well. And I think it might have been Queen Latifah's first movie. So we actually and I have a joke about this. You know, we die in the first half hour of Sphere. Queen Latifah and I, because
spoiler
they always
alert.
Yeah. Oh, punchline spoiler. Okay. Well, all right. That was a good punchline, but it got punched. Anyway, so we were both on set, and since we weren't the stars, and there weren't many actors in this movie. You know, Huey Lewis was also in it. He was the helicopter pilot who brought Dustin Hoffman to the base before they all went in the submarine down under. But Queen Latifah and I were military personnel in the biosphere at the bottom of the sea. And so we had the minor roles. And so we had smaller trailers, and her trailer was right next to mine. And then the trailers of Sharon Stone and Dustin Hoffman were larger, you know, little compounds. But me and Queen, we had the small trailers. However, she was already getting famous. Like, everything was happening real fast for her. So it's like the all the, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Peter Coyote and
Samuel Jackson. You know,
Samuel Jackson. They were all like really enthralled. You know, anytime she came by, she was very aloof, and it was really cool. But my trailer was, across the way from hers, and she really kind of kept to herself and her personal assistant. So they would get, you know, we would all eat in the same little area, me and the stars. And then, but Queen Latifah's personal assistant, who was really, really hot, would bring the tray to Queen Latifah, shut the door. And that was it. And I would look through my little Venetian blinds to see if I saw anything, but I never saw the trailer rocking.
So you never went a knocking.
I never went a knocking.
What happens in the movie? Like, they discover a spaceship buried underneath the ocean, and then
nothing happens.
Nothing happens.
This movie is incredibly dull.
Didn't James Cameron come out with The Abyss around the same time?
You think it is inspired Avatar?
No, Titanic. The Abyss, the film The Abyss, which was a pioneering film because it had, it was the first film to have CGI, computer generated graphics, in that scene with the water tube coming out and imitating the woman's face.
The Abyss came first.
The Abyss?
Yeah.
So Sphere was a knockoff of The Abyss then.
Well, you were going to say, Margot, one other interesting thing.
Yeah. Thanks. They both sort of happened around the same time. So I think that was just parallel universe underwater happening. Uh-huh. Interesting tie-in to Ellen and Sphere. When the movie was pretty much close to opening, this was when my agent at CAA decided to dump me because everybody knew this movie was going to be a flop. And for some reason, I got dumped. But we had our movie premiere in Hollywood, and I was very excited. You know, first movie premiere, red carpet, all that. But it wasn't at the Man's Chinese Theater. It was at the Man's Westwood, right? So
at
it's a movie premiere. basically, it was by UCLA.
Oh, that's disappointing. Well, I mean, did you get to read the script before you decided to do the role, or you're just like happy to be in anything?
I'd happy to be in anything. But back to the, I was just having a little sip of water. So we had the premiere, all right, the red carpet, and then it was at some sort of one of these legendary deli places, restaurants, where they have parties, right? Like, you know, after the Oscars, they have a party at some famous, like, old school restaurant. So we went to that. I saw the movie, and I watched it, and it was bad. It was bad. But I want to tell you about Ellen and Anne Haitch. Sharon Stone will always be on the top of my list because she was lovely for the entire filming of Sphere. And then when we were at the premiere, I actually had a title card. You know, there are only 5 human beings in this film. The rest is just jellyfish and sea anemones. And so you see Dustin Hoffman, you know, and then this is the premiere. So everyone is in the industry and they're all applauding. Not even as fans, but they're all applauding because if not, you know, they'll lose their jobs. So enthusiasm, 5 big name actors, you see their names. And finally, it's my name. I get my own title card and I was stressing out because it's like, nobody knows who I am. They're not going to applaud. And it did. It's like my name appeared on the screen and there was a little bit of silence. And then Sharon Stone led her row in applause, and then the whole theater applauded. It's like, I don't know who the fuck she is, but
that's really
I
thought nice that of her was to do that.
It was amazing because I didn't want to lead the applause. Hey, bitches!
I led the applause. Recently at something. I was like, oh, you're applauding for me? Yay!
Woo-woo. So that's the same thing that Cher said when the trailer for the movie with Silkwood came on the screen. And I think that was like Cher's kind of breakout film role.
Yes.
That was like Meryl Streep and everyone's like, ooh. And then when, you know, Cher's name came on and Cher was in a movie theater sitting watching another movie, people started laughing.
Oh.
And she was like heartbroken by that.
That was that period of her life where she was kind of a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
She was the butt of a joke because she, you know, had that variety show and it was campy and stupid. So people were like, ah, Cher, whatever.
And I was just like, now look who's laughing now.
And then Moonlight came out after that.
Yeah.
Moonstruck.
Yeah. Right. She won the Oscar for that.
Oh, yeah. No. I love Cher. So. And I love Cher impersonators as well. Anything Cher, I will take.
So cool.
So at the premiere party, at the after party for Sphere, Ellen was there. Ellen DeGeneres and her new love, Anne Haitch. And this was just before Anne Haitch lost her shit and wound up at that farmhouse in Central California asking the lady for slippers. This was just before all that happened. Anne Haitch, of course, up to that point with Ellen, had been thought of as a heterosexual, and suddenly she was in a lesbian relationship, and it was big news, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm watching this this movie Sphere, and I'm thinking, how this movie really sucks. This movie is really boring. And then when I saw that Ellen was at the premiere party, I thought, oh, this will be great because Ellen's a comedian and we'll be able to make fun of it together. And I go up to Ellen and, you know, we knew each other, you know, peripherally from back in the 80s in San Francisco. And I say, hey, Ellen, hey, good to see you. And then I say, what about that movie? And she's going, oh, it was amazing. And then, because Anne Haitch had just made a film with Barry Levinson, Wag the Dog, which was a great film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she was going, yeah, I didn't want it to end. And I'm just looking at them. It's like, oh my gosh, they're not well. And then Anne Haitch is asking a farm farm lady for slippers. So
yeah. Well, how often is it that lesbians are possessed by aliens? Isn't that what she said? What happened to her?
Yeah.
Yes.
She had an alien inside sphere. Her.
It was the sphere.
The sphere monster.
It made me a lesbian, and it made me like sphere.
Well, like, you know, at that time period, Hollywood was trying to put these, you know, sort of counterculture or intelligent or, you know, smart alecky women into these action film roles. Like Anne Heche was in Volcano.
Right. Angelina Jolie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In what was the it was a video game.
Lara Croft.
Nice, Mark. Very nice.
And God, there were so Thank many. You. Like even who co-starred in the puppy episode with Ellen? She was an action film star from Jurassic Park.
Laura Dern.
Yeah. So it was like all these kind of like really strong women, you know, personalities were getting put into action film roles, and it, you know, it played well at the box office, and certainly like you were part of that movement. And then all the, you know, fast forward to today, it feels like, you know, so much has come and gone. And, you know, like with the COVID pandemic, it has been some kind of cultural apocalypse, because everybody now is going from doing like theater roles, and even like films are being released online. Like everything, it's like theater and online streaming have merged into an unrecognizable blob, and you're in the center of it all.
Theater and online streaming? Yeah.
Yes, the middle of that blob.
Like the spanking, your work in the show, was it Spanking Machine, for example?
Yes, the one I'm working on now, yeah. I mean, I've been working on it since COVID shut it down. And so I got to, but also just... on the positive spin, there are a lot of women playing action heroes, right? I mean, I'm not into Marvel or any of those things, but they are there. They're, you know, but yeah, the movies aren't my thing anymore. So when Spanking Machine was starting to open, I was in rehearsals at Brava Theater here in San Francisco. I wasn't paying attention to the news. I kept hearing about this COVID. I kept hearing about a pandemic, but I just didn't think that, I just didn't see what the future held. And my show was supposed to open on March 13th, the first day of Shelter in Place in San Francisco. And it was so cute. There was a sign in front of the theater, postponed, and now it's over a year later, and I actually am in rehearsals to open the show at a different theater in San Francisco called The Marsh, and we're talking about the Delta variant, and it's very weird because nobody knows what the next week will bring or what tomorrow will bring, and if we're going to be allowed to open the shows that we invest so much time and, you know, a bit of money into. So I am definitely proudly upping my game virtually so that no matter what happens, I have a virtual backup plan.
I think that's really wise. And, you know, to be honest, it's like, one thing I just wish that a lot more artists sort of had gone into the digital realm before the COVID pandemic, just because part of it is like, it makes the work accessible. Like the only thing I don't like about streaming shows is that we can't watch them after the fact, you know? And it's just like, you know, like with television and film now, you can go on, you know, streaming services and watch your favorite shows. You can even watch Sphere, right, on HBO Max, whenever you want to. If it's available.
Well, I think, please do. I'll get a penny. I think that actually there's different ways of, there's live streaming, which I prefer to perform that way so that it's like theater, you know, so you had to be there. But there's also a way to make these performances available right now. Right now, Spanking Machine got accepted into a festival. I can't say the name of the festival yet, and it's a virtual festival. You know, they made it from a real in life festival to a virtual festival. And they are paying me to make a film of Spanking Machine that they'll play on demand on their platform. So I think that people, you know, can do it any manner of ways. You can stream it, but then you can also save the stream and edit the stream, or you can just create something specifically that you can stop and cut and enhance. Mm-hmm. Because you can do a lot more if you're actually pre-recording than you can live. The exciting part of it live is that, you know, it can just fall apart, and that's probably not, you know, but I do like, you know, I like the risk of it. I like watching knowing the performer is a little scared.
That's part of the charm, I think, you know, because we did this web series for about almost a decade now, Cooking with Drag Queens.
Oh, so good.
Thank you. It's a horrible mistake. Cooking with Drag Queens was an organic project that just came from the reality that we had drag queens in our home in full drag, and we were feeding them in order to tape this podcast.
But the first one was because I wanted to crush Tostones, because at the time there's a lot of news. There was a big legal argument going on whether it was legal to film women in stiletto heels crushing small animals as fetish videos. And I'm like,
oh no,
that is so weird that there's this crushing fetish going
on.
Oh,
I don't want to. Oh no, no. I wish I had not heard that. I have to try. Let's not repeat that.
Okay.
There's terrible things happening on the internet.
Yes.
And
no, but that's
well, yet, it's not there. Like, usually the crushing videos watermelons.
I'm taking my headphones off. Headphones are off. I'm going to put my headphones back on.
We're talking about fruit.
And we're not going to say crushing anything.
Anyway.
Okay.
We're talking about
fruit. My headphones are back on. Fruit.
And women and balloons. And it's a thing. So yes. Women like sitting on balloons. Women crushing watermelons between their legs.
Okay. That's good. I'm good. All right. So anyway, let's get back to Tostones.
So anyways, with the Tostones video, our friend Larry LaFontaine that we share in common, we were like, you were born to be an amazing drag queen. And Larry at the time had never been in drag and said, go get a wig, go buy some makeup, show up at our house, and we're going to go film a Tostones video, how to make Tostones with you. And Larry being an amazing person said, okay, yes, let's do it. And Larry took it like a duck to water. You would mm-hmm. never know in the video that was his first day in drag, first hours in drag. Mm-hmm. And Mark and I are like seasoned, salty old drag queens. We're like, stand over here, do this, do that, you know? And it became such a hit, organic hit with drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race that they all reached out to us and wanted to do the videos.
Yes.
And this grew and grew and grew and snowballed into things, you know, to the point that, like, you know, other cooking shows, I think like Food Network,
Cooking with Paris,
Cooking with Paris Hilton.
if it says Cooking with, then it's, you know,
Martha cooking. Stewart and Snoop Dogg's show.
Oh yeah.
So like there's 100,000 copies of the series. And to me, I thought it was like such a strange thing for people to like inspired by. And I think at the core of all it was the fact that we were showing drag queens how to cook, and they were terrified, so nervous about it.
Wow.
And I'm like, now we're celebrating 3,000 episodes of Feast of Fun
in
this year. And, you know, I've been inspired by actually seeing you show your organic process of doing streaming shows and going through the awkwardness of it and, you know, technical fumbles and just mm-hmm. being very raw, being very present. You know, you're a huge star, Marga, and it's like, and you're putting yourself out there in the most rawest sense, because you're just allowing the world to see you at your most vulnerable. And I thought, you know, this is a really exciting direction to take Cooking with Drag Queens. So for our 3,000 episode, what I wanted to invite the listeners to do is to help us raise the funds to get the technology possible to turn Cooking with Drag Queens into a streaming show. And the cool thing about it is it wouldn't require a crew to run all the cameras. It would be, you know, the technology is at the point now that you can sort of automate some of these things. But the most mm-hmm. exciting thing about it is that it allows it to become a show that you see as it's happening.
and you can see the disaster happen. You can see
it'd be live.
The terror in people's faces. You can see the food not succeed.
Well, because what some people don't realize is sometimes, you know, we make these recipes 4, 5, 6. I mean, some of those, there's things we've made 20, 30 times. But if it's something new to us, we'll make it 5 or 6 times before we do it. And I don't know if that's always going to be possible. You know?
And so the cool thing here is like, and this is like why I'm inspired by your work, Marga in the Morning, is that you're trying to take yourself in a direction that makes it, you know, more accessible, easier, funner to make work for audiences around the world and, you know, have another career based on this this experiment that you're doing. Can you talk about Marga in the Morning?
Oh, thank you for asking. It began because I was going to be in this Facebook group where people, they post a video and they're prompted, and it was very therapy-like. And then I decided I had done it in April. I didn't want to do it again, but all I really wanted to do was to be held accountable to live stream every day. And also, I had been waking up at 2 in the afternoon and I realized this isn't good. I just felt like my energy was bad. I felt like I was really falling behind on so much. And because I grew up in a show business household, everybody slept afternoon. Everybody. And if I could, I would. And I have never been someone who could just voluntarily say, yes, I will have that phone meeting at 10 a.m. I always tell people I'm busy till noon. So I thought I would combine those two purposes in. I'm going to live stream every day and I'm going to be on a personal journey for the month of August to become a morning person. And then I began it very minimally. I remember you saw the first one and I was using my iPhone because in this group that I was in, they want you to get away from the technology and just talk to people. So I was using the iPhone, but it didn't have a, I didn't have a good audio method, a solution for it. So it was just bouncing around my kitchen. Then you left that comment, and I think I yelled at you on my live stream.
About the green screen?
No.
That was like another time.
Plug in your microphone.
Yeah, but no, the whole point was just to, you know, just to do it like poorly. And
Gorilla.
Then I realized, no, but I listened to it. Yeah, but then I listened to it and I thought, no, that doesn't sound good. And then you can't use the earbuds because you're too close to the camera.
Right.
So I went out to Guitar Center and I got a lav. I don't know if you ever realized, I bought a $40 iRig lav and it was nice. And then I made a YouTube tutorial about it. But then I just said, oh, you know what? Fuck that group anyways. I'm not going to bother with the phone. I started bringing in my camera. I just use the webcam now, not my fancier camera, but I was doing it in the kitchen and it still had that vibe. Like we're in the kitchen and all I do basically is take horoscope requests. And then I read the horoscopes and people are very happy and I say good morning. And I woke up at, you know, I woke up in time to do an 11 a.m. stream. Today, I woke up at 9:30 a.m. It's just nothing that I've done in my adult life.
9:30 a.m., what have you done with Marga Gomez?
What have I done? Yeah, I mean, I still don't like it, but, you know, I do feel like sometimes it's only 5 in the afternoon. I go, wow, is it bedtime yet? Because I've been up since 9 or 10. And now I realize why morning people are so boring, you know, like they ruin clubs and they ruin shows because like they're all set to go to bed. So now my new thing is to get myself into bed by 1 a.m. So I'm not such a mess all day. So basically, Fausto, I'm just trying to, experiment with, going live every day with trying to talk and lose the filler words, which I still have a problem with the ums and the uhs, and try to get a verbal flow going. It's going to take me some time and I'm going to be easy on myself as I do it. If people can suffer through it, then I'm just going to continue till August 31st.
Kit Shapiro, Eartha Kitt's daughter, said on the podcast that when she was a child, her mother would play that game where she had to describe everything in the room. And if she used filler words, she had to start all over again.
Yeah.
Can you imagine playing that game with Eartha Kitt?
Play it again.
So I want you to describe everything in the room. And if you say like, or you know, or what's going on, bub, then you're going to have to start all over again.
That's true. So I want to be evil. I want to spit tax. That's not going to work.
You know, like, I want to be evil. Like, yeah, for sure.
So, Margaret, you've become a big online presence, and in fact, you're sharing parts of your life, and even some romantic encounters you've shared. Can we talk about
the date?
The date, because Fausto and I were like, we were super invested in that. I was in tears because it seemed like, wow, this is true love right here. You know, true love that someday I hope to experience.
Hey. No, but this is so we have to explain to the listeners what's going on here. So
yeah.
Marga was streaming on Instagram, right? And
yes.
you invited us to join you.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking we were somebody else.
I was experimenting with Instagram Live. Yeah.
We were somebody more famous. And so you invited us and you're like, I'll make the best of the bad situation. And so we were like hanging out there and you started talking about this woman that you had a crush on and she happened to be listening to it. And so we invited her onto the chat to the share the screen. And it turned out that you guys had kind of an affinity for each other.
And her friend joined too from another to kind of like verify that this person was not like a terrible person.
Or pulling your leg.
Yes.
Right. It was like her best friend from childhood. So that was very promising.
And we asked her, are you ready to go on a date with Marga? Is this serious?
And she's like, yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
But when push came to shove, she never showed up.
And she just chickened out.
Well, it wasn't, no, it, actually she's a
Well,
she's
you guys went
nurse.
On the date. You'd actually she's managed a
nurse,
on a date.
And yeah, she was on call. She had to go help six people. She had to help sick people. So, you know, I let that slide.
She was a COVID nurse.
So we rescheduled it and we went on that date and that date sucked.
Worse than the sphere?
I think I would have gone in the sphere if they said, listen, you can get out of this right now. Just have to, go underwater.
It seems so promising.
There'll be jellyfish and it'll sting a little bit, but you won't be with her. Yeah, I know. It's so weird.
Why was it bad? Describe what you guys did. You went on to this date.
She was not smiley. She didn't like the look of me. I didn't like the look of her. That was basically like right from the first second.
Oh, she was frowning?
She was so smiley on the Instagram.
Because we were watching.
Yes.
It was the male gaze.
She doesn't know
who the hell we are. Maybe she's a fan of ours, but what, you know, she thought we were big stars because we speak with authority. And she wasn't going to be like a schlump in front of the camera and the cameras are rolling. She had her A game poker face on.
I should have gone live on my phone, get some smiles out of her.
And so you went on. So you went on this date with her. Where did you guys go? To a coffee shop, a restaurant?
We met. You know, she lived a little bit out of town, and so we decided to meet at this very romantic spot, the Ferry Building in San Francisco. It was a beautiful, warm day. I thought I had a cute outfit on, but it was windy in the lift because you don't want to get the spit in your eyes. And so I asked, I rolled down all the windows. My hair was blowing around and I happened to have a bandana. I tied it around my head and I don't think I did that last check on my hair. So I might have looked a little insane. Then I go to find her and we're under the clock. We're meeting under the clock and I see her and I don't have the best eyes at my age. And so I'm just like, is that her? And I was kind of slow. And then I heard her go, yeah, it's me. And she was wearing a long parka. It was, and flip flops, and that kind of, you know, that just, I didn't understand. I have
was
a
she
thing.
Comfortable?
Apparently she was pretty comfortable.
So she was a woman.
She was
in,
warm.
As they say in the 90s, she was a woman with comfortable shoes.
They weren't even shoes. She was practically barefoot. You know, she had those, like, the cheapest flip-flops you could have. I mean, you know.
A parka and flip-flops.
And there's flip-flops.
Did she have
parka.
Nice feet? You didn't even look at them because you were like, flip-flops, no.
Yeah, because the thing is I've been told that I can't hide anything on my face. And so I think when I saw her and I looked at the flip-flops, I think she just saw my panic, the panic on my face. And then I had been so excited that now, the first time in the pandemic, I was going to hug someone. I thought this was all romantic. It was so romantic on Instagram with the two of you and her. And I thought, oh, this hug is going to feel wonderful. And so I go up to her and I'm just, I wanted to savor it. I wasn't all herky-jerky rushing. And then I'm sort of going to my arms were extended, and she says, bring it in, bring it in. And it's like, what are we on a field hockey team? And so then I go to hug her, and then she does that hug where they pat you on the back.
Oh, I hate that. The condescending Midwestern Caucasian hug.
Yeah.
There, dear.
Yeah. And then that was it. It was
like,
over for me.
I do not need your charity.
Yeah. And so, and I don't know. I thought I looked cute, and yeah, maybe my hair was a mess and the bandana was askew and I looked like some sort of sloppy chola, but I thought the rest of me looked nice and I had shoes. She didn't.
I just don't understand why she changed her opinion of you after, because she seems so eager and enthusiastic to be in a space with you to share. Because the idea here is that you guys had been socially isolated and this was going to be the first time you had a hug after the isolation of the COVID pandemic.
I must have had just the worst expression on my face when I looked at her feet. And I think when she saw that was it. And there was
really,
no
turning
back.
Really, she felt judged by you.
I think she felt, she absolutely did. I think either, and I've always wanted to ask her, you know, was it my appearance or my looking at your appearance? What was it? I just am curious, you know, but I think that, yeah, I think she must have felt judged. I mean, how could she was wearing a parka and flip flops on a warm day. And then, yeah, then after that, it was, you know, everything she said, I wasn't interested in. And, we didn't click at all. And I don't want to say anything more about it because I could really,
she might be listening to this.
Oh God.
But she seems like she's had a lot to deal with. So she probably doesn't have time to deal with, you know, what.
How would she know? How would she know? I mean, I don't think she
might have your name on Google Alert and she goes and checks.
Shit.
Cause what is it? With a spanking machine.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no.
She might.
Oh, please edit this out. Cut this out. Oh, please. Oh no. What have you done?
Spanking machine.
And I told myself,
what?
I told myself I wouldn't talk about her when we had this schedule, our schedule. I told myself I'm not going to talk about her again.
I was emotionally invested in this.
I've gone
though.
Too far. But sometimes, you know, with
because
life
it was,
and love,
it was,
you have to take risks.
But you know, she shouldn't hug people like that.
You were gonna meet her. It didn't happen. It was very casual, kind of like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't make it. You brought it to Facebook. People were like, oh, that's terrible.
To be fair, I said to her, if you don't make Marga feel good, we will read you to filth. She knew what she was getting into.
Well,
I think we've been very polite and very generous about it. We could be like, oh, what a terrible person she was.
I was going to get into it though, but I stopped just in time.
Yes.
I forgot. I just thought that we were like, you know, talking
on the
our
phone.
Facebook. Yeah, I thought we were on the phone. Oh, wow. I put the brakes just in time. But I think to wrap it up, I said she's a wonderful person. And I wish her the best.
Dolly Parton.
But don't hug people. Don't slap you know, backslap hug people, you know, after what we've been
Maybe
through.
Maybe she's hugging you the best way she can.
Okay. You know what I'm saying? Fuck you. I swear to God.
Why?
You're just like, you're gaslighting me. You're gaslighting me right now. You lured me into talking about this atrocious hug, and now you're saying, oh, well, that's the best she could do.
What I was filming a video for, like, my audition for, I had already been accepted for on the TV show Alt for Norge, which is, you know, exploring my Norwegian ancestry. I met my cousin. We filmed something. He gave me a hug. He patted me on the back like that, and Fausto made us do, like, two or three takeovers because my cousin kept patting me on the back like that. And Fausto's just like, it's not a genuine hug.
It didn't look good.
Yeah, it doesn't look good.
Did they use it on the show? No, they didn't. No, because he couldn't get him.
Eventually, he gave me a hug.
I said, love him, Captain. Love them all.
All right, Fausto.
So hugs are important, and the way you hug somebody is important, and the way you don't hug somebody. Because, see, like, Fausto's the hugger, right? Like, if you came here, Marga, Fausto would give you a hug. I would give you a hug because I know you. I love you. But, like, you know, I don't want to hug every casual acquaintance I know. And Fausto's just like, hi, hug, hug. And then they look to me, and I'm just kind of like, I may shake your hand, but with COVID, maybe not.
No, I know.
COVID has changed the game.
I was a great hugger, but yeah. So you're right, Fausto. That's probably the best she could do. And who knows what trauma she's been through. And I'm the asshole. I'm the asshole.
I'm not saying you're an asshole.
No. Well, I'm saying that. Fuck you, Fausto. I'm the asshole. Can't you let me have that?
Okay, you're the asshole.
Thank you. I feel better now. Ellen, I'm patting myself on the back.
Ellen and Queen Latifah are like,
give yourself a hug.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I did? I've been not super lonely, you know, as lonely as and part of me is like, I'm glad because I don't like to share a bed. But part of me, like, really, I get itchy in the back. And that's really what I miss most now. Like, all the sex and the hugging, but really what I miss now from being in a relationship is getting someone to scratch that spot in the back. So guess what I did? I bought myself a back scratcher. I don't need anybody now.
Oh, how do you like it?
It's so good.
I was trying to get Fausto one because he was always asking me to scratch his back. I'm like, I'm going to just get you a back scratcher. Or he's like, he finds a corner of a wall and he's all like, nyah, 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 like a bear.
I'll use a knife. Jam. I love like a sharp knife.
That's so Puerto Rican. That's so Puerto Rican.
Is it?
Yeah. And then flossing your teeth with a matchbook cover, doing that too.
I didn't realize people don't have
matchbook covers anymore.
Whatever's handy.
The twisty ties.
People don't carry matches. You know, not like they used
I know. I'm talking back in the day, old school Puerto Rican tooth flossing.
Yeah. Well, I used to be a heavy smoker, right? And, you know, a couple packs a day during my partying times. And when I lived in Germany, I'm there and I'm digging through my pockets. I'm pulling out matches and like more matches and more matches. I'm just kind of like putting them on the bar. And the German woman goes, so you are never without fire. I'm like, no, I never am without fire. Thank you.
So, Marga, this is going to be a big, big year for Latinos in film.
I'm Queen Latina.
Latinx.
Queen Latina.
Queen Latina. So, In the Heights came and went. People didn't like that it didn't have enough Afro-Caribbean representation. Even
Lin-Manuel, it was complicated.
It was complicated. What were your thoughts of In the Heights?
Well, I saw it on Broadway. I went to China to do the lottery and get the $20 ticket or the $10 ticket, and I wound up paying $100 to see it. And I didn't love it, actually. You know,
Because I felt like the whole lottery ticket was so last season of Roseanne plot device, you know, like you win a lottery.
People would win it, though. They would line up, but they did that for a Book of Mormon. But when I saw
the plot of the show is about, you know, the grandma winning the lottery and driving the action. Lottery. And I feel like, you know, it's just a lazy screenwriting.
It was corny. It looked like the electric company,
Was that the neighborhood you grew up in?
The Hulu movie of the electric. Yeah, no, it didn't. I didn't Yeah, it did nothing for me.
You grew up in Washington Heights, though.
I grew up in Washington Heights. I mean, what I liked about In the Heights was the album, you know? Mm. But to the book was like, this is corny. I mean, but to be honest, I thought the same thing when I saw Rent. You know, I thought, I mean, I love the performances, but there's just something about getting it right that's very hard to do with something like the Lower East Side and Washington Heights. So... yeah. And then, the film, I probably would like it more, but it's just, it would really bum me out knowing, the way, the demographic is in the Heights to apparently what they did where the leads were very light skinned. And then the main dark skinned lead was also the villain and all, you know, I would just be too busy thinking and not enjoying the film. So I'll watch it eventually, but yeah, just, I'm not in a rush.
Yeah, it's a missed opportunity, and part of it is like it feels like Lin-Manuel Miranda's kind of like divorced himself from the role. Like he saw his appearance in the film as a cameo, you know. And I'm like the whole plot, the whole Pete Agua guy, the snow cone guy in the musical, is that he's struggling alongside all the other characters are struggling. Yeah. And then when, you know, chaos ensues when there's a blackout. And then there's heat. He comes out and he's like singing his Pete Agua song again. And he's like, I'm doing great business at the time of crisis, you know? And so, yeah. So it was the message of his character and his song was like, even through terrible circumstances, good things can happen. And that was completely taken out from the film, in the film, you know? And I thought that was a really missed moment because it was one of my favorite moments in the musical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I also thought, you know, in terms of like representation, you know, Latinx people in 2021 are thick. We like to eat and we like to dance and we like to fuck.
Oh, were they all fit? Were they all fit?
Skinny, skinny, skinny.
Oh my God.
And I was like, where are the curves?
Well, the background players were thick.
Now, even the background players, there were a few, but
there were several that were.
And you if they had more, you know, curvaceous leaves.
Oh, the background players are darker and probably like more from the neighborhood. I mean, the same thing with the L word. You would see the L word and it's like, I don't know. I've never seen lesbians like this. And then the lesbians who looked like the lesbians that, you know, I would see, you know, you'd see in Park Slope or, you know, in Berkeley or San Francisco, they'd always be in the background. You know, they go. They go to the planet, right? Wherever the leads would go. And then you'd see like just, you know, plain lesbians sitting like, you know, farther away from them.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, like Mark Anthony, a lot of people thought that this film was going to be a breakout. And Mark Anthony, like he starved himself for the role that he played. And when we saw him, we were like, oh my God, give him a pastel or something.
Mark Anthony?
Yeah, he was in the movie.
He plays a junkie.
Oh, wow.
He plays a junkie in the movie.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Cause he's kind of dark. Yeah.
So, you know, when I saw him in the movie, I was like, that can't be Mark Anthony. And it was, and I was just like, oh, Dios mío.
He doesn't have to lose weight to play a junkie. That's so amazing.
Yeah. He looked spent.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he got COVID and he's just like, I'll do this anyway. Well,
I guess the movie was made before COVID. Ben Affleck then, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, in terms of like, you know, hopes and aspirations of representation, we're seeing a lot of that stuff online and in online media. And certainly this has been Lil Nas X's, you know, moment to shine, where you're having a queer black, you know, artist shining and going mainstream and succeeding and being very unapologetic
and
about
buckets of money being funneled into that career.
Yeah. Know, it's
you've never seen before.
It's groundbreaking. And yet at the same time, we're seeing West Side Story, which already people are sort of giving themselves up for disappointment. You know?
Oh, no, I don't even want to think about that really.
So Kushner from Angels of America has rewritten the book for West Side Story. Tony Kushner. And Steven Spielberg is directing and co-producing the new adaptation. And it does take place, you know, I guess it does take place in the 1950s, 60s or so. Mm. And there is a lot of references to the original film. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, like, how, you know, a lot of people feel like they could have brought in Black Lives Matter, brought in, you know, more contemporary issues.
Yeah, like or they could have gotten, I mean, you know, Tony Kushner's a genius, but it's not for him to write this.
Right.
We have Luis Alfaro, we have gifted Latinx playwrights and screenwriters, and it's just, that's so important. Oh, and Steven Spielberg.
Steven. And here in Chicago, the Ravinia Music Festival just launched their Music Box Theater, which has an interactive, people describing it kind of as a Disney ride for the music festival dedicated to the artist and musicality of Leonard Bernstein, who composed West Side Story. And we went over the weekend and saw the grand opening and the concert. And, you know, right now there is a lot of energy being put onto West Side Story and to Latinx, this kind of hybrid thing, like the Americanization or the, you know, I don't want to say whiteification, but, you know,
colonialization.
I don't even want to say, cause those are like negative terms. It's like the mainstreaming or marketing Latinx stuff. You appreciate
Leonard Bernstein's work in West Side Story.
He's a genius, you know, and anybody's going to say Leonard Bernstein's work is pulled from cultures around the world. He's a globally celebrated music composer. One of the greatest musicians of the 20th century.
We can keep Lenny. We'll keep Lenny.
And Rita Moreno's back.
And Rita Moreno, she plys Officer Krumke. No, I'm just kidding. Gosh.
We don't know her role.
She plays Valentina, according to the IMDb.
So. Who's Valentina?
I don't know. Her grandma.
Oh.
Do you think she's going to be
should have played Officer Krupke. That would have been fantastic. I know.
Hey, you guys! But there was also like a non-binary character.
You know, I worked with
character.
Rita Moreno.
You
did? You know that?
No.
Yes.
How?
Yes, I was in the Vagina Monologues with Rita Moreno.
Right. And
how did you miss that? I was surprised you didn't. I thought you were doing a segue to when I work with Rita Moreno. Yes.
Well, and, I thought that was a personal moment that you had with
what kind
other.
Of vagina monologue did you deliver?
Is that like a euphemism for something you did in the bedroom?
Well, yeah, now that I live alone, you know, with just backslaps.
It's a dialogue, not a monologue.
Yeah. No, this was in the, I know, was this in, this was, I think, 2000, whenever the Vagina Monologues started, you know, playing off Broadway.
Yeah.
And they would just get, and it was basically like the easiest gig I ever had. You just go and your lines are on these big index cards. And then you just have to, eventually you wind up memorizing these cards. And it's like Reader's Theater, something they used to call Reader's Theater. And it's Eve Ensler's play, and they take, names and celebrities, and I was somewhat still of a celebrity in 2002, and I wound up in the New York production, and then I wound up first in the San Francisco production, and that one had Rita Moreno and Vicki Lawrence, and I had never done anything like that. I just done stand up, and I'd done my one person shows, and I didn't really know how to be a vagina. And so the first couple of shows, my vagina was not satisfactory. And I got a call from the producer in New York, and I guess I was going to get fired. So what I did was I bought a video camera. I set it up, and I performed into the camera, and I saw what I was doing wrong. I went into the theater that night and I nailed it. I nailed all my vaginas.
Wow.
And then after the show, Rita said, because they wanted me fired. Rita and Vicki, they wanted me fired. And Rita says to me, I don't know what you're on, but stay on it. You know?
Oh, really? You think that Rita and Vicki were wanting to fire you? Or
they were not a fan.
I had a vibe. Okay. The first night of the production, we all went out for a steak dinner. Producer took us all out for steak. The producer, though, he wanted me to split a steak with him because he didn't want to spend extra money and he didn't value me like he did Rita and Vicki. But anyways, we all had the dinner. We were all laughing. We hadn't done the show yet. And And everybody was super friendly. I mean, Rita is super, super friendly, right? Unless you suck at your part, you're not doing your job. First show, it was like, huh. Didn't go, everybody went their separate ways. And, you know, I knew something was weird. And then the second show, Rita, after the show, Rita leans over to Vicky after the show in the wings and says, let's go get some wine. And it was like, wait, but there's three of us. I didn't get invited. And then I knew something. And then the next day I get the call. So I can't, I can only put it together that.
Listen, you know, Rita Moreno, all I got to say is one day at a time. Did you see that on Netflix?
It's on my list to watch. But,
not her greatest moments. Just saying.
Oh,
she's a legend. That accent, I love her.
Some people loved that show. I couldn't get into it.
We call it one day at a time because she put on this very
a crazy Cuban. Googie Gomez, right? She does it from she's back in the Ritz. But listen, I just want to just say, for anybody who's listening, please. Please keep this in my little Rita segment. She loves me now. I go backstage when she's performing and yes, she loves me. She gave me a card. We have selfies together. It was just these two rough days. I was terrible. I watch and I would advise people. And that's the amazing thing about streaming is you can be your own director. A lot of actors, they don't want to, or performers, they don't want to watch themselves on camera. Then you are cheating yourself of growth. You have to see what the viewer sees. And sure, it's a video camera. It's not like live, but it's a lot like live. If you suck, you're going to see it. So, And
did you get to see the film, the documentary that everybody's saying is fantastic?
Not yet. Not yet. Moreno. I can't wait.
Just a girl who decided to go for it.
Yeah. No. I saw her one woman show here in the Bay Area. I saw her cabaret show here in San Francisco. You know, she used to, I don't know if she still has a home in San Francisco, but this is where she lived for a long time in the East Bay. And, her daughter grew up here and she was involved with, you know, some theater, companies here. And with her husband, and I think her husband's name was Lenny, actually, oddly enough. And he passed, and then, you know, I think she actually had another, like, just another big bounce resurgence, and yeah, that led to a lot of stuff in LA. So I'm figuring that's probably where she is now.
Listen, we can all learn from Rita Moreno. Let's start dancing and dance every day. She is 89 years old and sharp as a tack and has her health and wits about her. And she's starring in films and performing still to this day. That's 89. Amazing.
Yeah.
89 years old.
Yeah. But if you're a terrible dancer, maybe just do an exercise bike. Because
or just shake your hips. Part of it is the thing about dancing, and I talk about this with Mark, and I talked about this a lot, is that when you're dancing, your body is doing exercise that you don't normally do when you're doing like yoga or Pilates. Your body's going to a pulse, to a rhythm, and it's moving your spinal column in a way that's very healthy.
Yeah. Well, I've actually just rearranged my living room where I film virtual shows, so that I have space to move. And in the midway through the pandemic, I bought a Bollywood dance program. And so I've yet to, for a whole year. And so I can see all the classes. And now I have space to learn Bollywood dancing.
Oh, that's exciting. Fausto and I took a Bollywood dancing aerobics class once. And it was hard because, you know, you're wearing sneakers on a wood floor, so you get a lot of traction. But like when you're doing that Bollywood kind of dance, you kind of want to move. So your hips are wanting to move, but your feet are kind of wanting to stay in the same spot.
Yeah, there's too much friction. You want shoes that move around.
And I just felt like I was like, ooh, my hips really got, like something happened there. Yeah.
Good point. I'll go over and get some like slippery, slidey slippers. Because I have a little carpet.
Marga, thank you so much for being such a role model to so many people. I know, like, what's so fascinating about you is that, like, we're hanging out with you. You've had these extraordinary experiences. You are a legend. You're celebrated and loved by hundreds of thousands of people. And yet you make everybody that hangs out and interacts with you feel like they're your best friend for life.
Oh, thank you.
And that's a really generous thing. I think someone described Carol Channing having that same ability. Just she, you know, and that's what the talent of a great performer is, that you invite people just to be, feel like they're right there with you.
Oh, you know that old saying, you meet the same people on your way up that you meet on the way down. So it's nice to be kind.
You know, and it is always nice to return the favor too, to the blows who have been rude to you.
Oh, yeah. But you it feels good to be a better person. I mean, my parents, they weren't generous. And so I fight against the imprint that they left on me to, you know, think that there's a scarcity of opportunity. It's not going to get you anywhere, right? You just have to, open up. And if you can give somebody a hand, give it to them. And then it's karma. It comes around, hopefully.
I mean, anytime you're doing something on the internet, I always stop and watch, even if it's a little bit, just because I always feel like I can learn something from it. And it motivates me. I feel like included in your success. And it's like, it makes me want to stream. It makes me want to create content. You know, it's like, for the COVID pandemic has had, a depressing impact. I don't know about other people, but for me and Mark, we've been like, you know, we lost Mark's mother this past year. My own mother's struggling with health issues.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
There's been a lot of like personal struggles that we've been dealing with. And, you know, to me, like some days I'm just like, what's the point of anything? And it is really the role of art and comedians and artists and performers like you that motivate everybody, including myself, to want to connect with the world again.
It's surprising how it, you know, people really frown upon Zoom shows and Zoom meetings and all this virtual presentations that are going on, but I have to say, I mean, it's as silly as it is to do this thing every morning at 11, I think that, you know, it is something. Like, somebody writes it in the chat. It's not like it's a Zoom thing, but I know they're there and I just wish them good morning. They wish it's so simple, but it's a touchstone. We have so little now for community that this is viable. And that's why I really hope that more people will live stream. You don't have to be an entertainer. You don't have to be an entrepreneur. You just have to turn on your camera and hit go live and just take 5-10 minutes and just say, I'm here. It really is. It's all we can do right now to stay safe and to share our hearts.
God, I've been like, I'm so inspired.
It's a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
Well, I'll watch you when you go live.
I think I'm going to have to do that.
I want to see. Well, you know what you do? I haven't seen you do it that much, Mark, but you do share still photos quite a bit. And that is something, you know, you're staying in touch with us by showing us your amazing muscles. But still, it's a journey. It's a progress.
Well, that's the thing. Update. It's like, you know, for me, it's like, I've not been in the gym a lot these last couple months, you know? So it's like, we're traveling a lot to Mark's mother's funeral and to my mother's birthday celebration, which, you know, was a very challenging experience. And you know, so I've not been, I don't, you know, I like, I sure I look more or less the way I do, but it's like, for me, I'm very critical. And people who like, you know, work out and build muscle and bodybuilders and stuff like that, they're very critical on their appearance. And so for me, I'm like, I don't want to take pictures of myself, you know, flexing, because I don't look the way I did 2 months ago.
I see.
You know, and that's like, I think that's also holds people back from streaming, is that they, or doing podcasts. They don't like the way they sound. They don't like the way they look.
Well, it's perfectionism, right? So you want everything to be perfect. And so instead of actually doing something, you don't do anything at all.
And I remember when we first started in this podcast and even doing like videos, and I was like, well, I wish I was more attractive. I wish I sounded better. Yeah. And I look back on it and I'm like, I was so beautiful and so charming, you know.
What happened?
100%. Now listen, here's the thing. And I actually, I'm really being vulnerable and raw, and you can share this or not, but as I've been doing these very minimalist streams every day, I'm using like a webcam to do it. I think I'm going to switch my setup tomorrow, but sometimes the camera catches me at, I mean, there's fewer great angles for me now than there used to be. And I just realized I've got this thing. Under my, this amazing comedian, you should have her on sometime, Marta Chavez. She's lives in Toronto, I think, but she was doing a show, one of my shows, and she says, I call it a pelican, but it's this horrible flip floppy thing under the chin. And I have tried to pretend it's not there. And the more I stream, the more I go, it's there. And I could take this down and nobody could see it, or I can just keep doing it. Mm. And that's what I'm doing now. It's like my body, my face, my chin is not what it was 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. And I don't care now. You know, it's like I'm just telling vanity to fuck off, because it's more important that I am present and I share my presence. And as people get older and they start getting self-conscious, like even more self-conscious about their appearance, that's when they should be streaming. Because I do find that older people, you know, I mean, even if they hit their 40s, 50s, 60s, you never see their images on their social media. It's always their pets. And I can't stand that. It's like, you don't want to show what you look like. Well, come on.
That's probably some residual resentment back from the days in the 90s on Craigslist with the lesbian dating ads. They always had like pictures of sunsets or mountain ranges. It was never like, here's a picture of me. Well, you know, for women, there's, you know, back in the day, safety issues, right? So you don't necessarily want to put that stuff out there, right?
Yes.
No, I know what you're saying, you know, and it's like we learned from Kathy Griffin on how to take a photo, because like we had pictures with her once and she's like, okay, you have to turkey neck it. Stick your face out really far away from your body, because then you don't get any double chin. And I'm like, wow, that really worked.
She was like a turtle.
Yeah, it was just all of a sudden her neck just,
right,
like, right, and straightforward. And then,
but I can't do that like at 11 in the morning every fucking day. It's like, so then I just open with it. Like
scarves.
I open with my turkey.
Well, lighting goes a long way. Good camera, good production values go a long way of distracting people from the fact that your body is decaying.
Right. I'm opening with that. My body's decaying, but you know,
When Fausto and I first met Lady Bunny, I took a picture, and Fausto and Lady Bunny are both in drag, and it's their profile, and they're talking to each other. And we went home and like looked at the photo later, and I think it was probably our first digital camera or something like that. Uh-huh. And we noticed, so like, oh my God, look at how hard that, because you know, I wasn't that experienced with drag queen makeup at the time. I was like, look at how hard like her neckline is and how dark her neck is compared to her face. So you know,
well, you can't spend, that's expensive, that makeup. You can't like put it everywhere.
No, yeah. you put a little darkener down there.
She just, you know, darkened the underneath of her chin to make her jaw pop out.
Yeah. And a little powder goes a long way.
I'll send
you the photo. You'll see it and you'll be like, ah.
Oh, Lady Bunny's so great.
Yeah.
Such a nice person. Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't hear it from me. Well,
we won't tell anyone.
Did you share a dressing room with Lady Bunny or something? Or
no, but, you know, in New York, and we were all kind of, you know, we all run into each other.
It's a small community.
Yeah, and I saw Lady Bunny like out of drag, I think, like on a subway platform.
I'm sorry.
It was like, oh. But yeah, no, I've seen them all. Jackie Beat. I mean, I think I actually lived in a loft with Jackie Beat for a while. But in San Francisco.
You lived with Jackie Beat, but you weren't sure?
Oh, no, no, no. Well, it's David Schweitzer, who's directed a lot of my shows, has this loft in New York. And Jackie B basically had a room there, but Jackie wasn't there all the time. So,
well,
you know,
I've had,
oh my God, one time in New York, I went to, I think it was before I knew, Jackie Beat's all thin now, right? Or yeah. Still? Yeah. So, but one time I went to a Jackie Beat show and I had just gotten really, really high and I walked in, a little bit late. And then, I don't even know if Jackie knew, I don't think Jackie knew me at the time, but just spent 5 minutes just, you know, ripping me a new one. Yeah.
I bet that was very uncomfortable knowing you. That was probably very uncomfortable for you.
It was, well, it killed my high. It killed my high. I wasn't high anymore.
She popped your bubble.
Yeah. No longer stoned. Thanks, Jackie Beat.
I mean, she's got a wicked, wicked sense of humor.
I saw her get into a fight with an audience one time here in Chicago. It was epic.
What, she called them meth heads or something, didn't she?
She was just people. I don't know what was going on, but it was like it was a winter night. It was in December, and she came to do our show, and she was obsessed with this puppet I had. There was a crystal skull puppet. And she was like, I must have it. I'll give you $1,000 for it. And I was like, you're insane, but I will be happy to make you a crystal skull puppet for free. For free. I said to her, no, I want that one. And I was like, okay. So let's tape our podcast. We taped our podcast. We got her into our broken down Toyota.
I mean, she was a real trooper. If she'd come out of that hotel, saw that car that we picked her up in, she probably would have just turned around and walked away. But she got in it.
She got in it. We did the show with her. We took her to the venue. She performed, and the audience there had a weird energy. And she was reading her lines. You know, she does karaoke. She goes parody songs.
Right.
And she had a book, and she's like reading off of it. And she stops her performance and is like, will you guys shut the fuck up? Like, she's just like... And, you know, it was a moment where, as we say in performance, that she lost the audience, right? And so the audience is like, boo, fuck you, Jackie B. You're a legend, but you're being so rude. Blah. And she was like, you're a bunch of crackheads, meth heads. You know, like. And then afterwards, she had a meet and greet, and she wouldn't sign anything unless they had bought something. It was like, it was a situation where Pia brought her, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just this huge fight happening. And I was like, I was marveling at it. It was an immovable force, a movable object meeting an unstoppable force. And it was an explosion.
That's my favorite.
And there were people in drag in the audience. And, you know, so it was very theatrical.
She was fighting with her own kind, even?
Yeah, The club kids.
This is a 5 a.m. place it closes at 5 a.m. on Saturday. So she probably went on like after midnight. So, you know,
sure.
It's tough.
Yeah. It was a tough crowd. It was a tough venue. It was a blizzard.
This is before she had her hip replacement. So she was probably in chronic pain. So, you know.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I'm all for that. I'm all for telling some people to shut the fuck up. I had that, you know, this with cell phones. I mean, right now, you know, if the show goes on, I told the theater, it's like, if I see anybody remove the mask, I'm stopping the performance. However, as a trade-off, I'm going to allow people to check their text messages and scroll Facebook all through my show. I just keep your mask on. That's all. I'm asking.
John Waters performed once, and somebody was video recording him, and he pointed them out and had the ushers like have them removed. He's like, "There's somebody up there in the balcony of the second row who's got filming. Da da da. Please remove them." Right in the middle of the show, we're like, "Wow!" And of course, Patty LuPone.
He had
famously.
Ushers. Yeah. No, I just have the same person who runs the lights and sounds and takes the tickets and folds the chairs up at the end. So yeah, they're not going to be able to. I guess I'd be my own usher. I need to bring an usher costume I need to throw anyone out.
Do you know how to throw somebody out of like a bar or a club if you need to? You got to get the hands behind their back and then you just keep pushing them because they don't really have much of an option to go anywhere but forward.
You know what? I think a cop did that to me once.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about this cop the other day. And this was way back, in the 80s. And suddenly, I think I was making there were payphones. Kids. All right, this is a long story. It was before USA for Africa. I was at a payphone. I got off the phone, and then suddenly somebody runs behind me and has my hands behind my back. And he's going, "All right, just go with me." And then I realized it was this cop, and he had me lean against the car. And I said, why are you doing this? He goes, "You were smiling." And apparently someone had been calling the police station, like doing crank calls. And then he saw me at a payphone, and being a cop genius, he assumed I was the person who had been calling because it was the phone booth. People make calls on it.
And you were smiling.
But that was I said, why are you were smiling? And it's like, you know, this was before Black Lives Matters or anything. It was just like I saw the insanity face to face. I went, okay, these people can be not our friends.
Mm.
Marga, thank you so much for joining us for this in-depth podcast look at the history of LGBT performance and your life, and putting Ellen and Rosie and Queen Latifah on blast. And
oh, no.
And your online dating hijinks.
Thank you, Fausto and Mark, for getting me canceled at last.
Again. You can't cancel somebody who's already been canceled.
Yeah.
What?
That's what I said to our friend Vivacious. She's like, "You'll be canceled." I'm like, "You can't cancel somebody that's been canceled 10,000 times already. Every day somebody's going to cancel you. You know, somebody's going to want something from you.
Oh,
you can't
I know.
Give it to them. So you're canceled. Well, you know what?
I'm
still doing me, and I'm still doing this, and I'm still doing that. And so whatever.
I think as long as you're willing to have a conversation and listen and learn and grow and love, it's really, you know, nothing to fear from any of these malevolent forces on the internet.
But yeah, I don't want to have any conversations. No, just cancel me now. I don't have time for the conversation.
I want to leave here the audience, and I want you to comment on this because, you know, with the Olympic Games happening,
Know anything about them.
I don't know anything about it either. But 23 openly LGBT athletes have won medals, which is the largest number.
Sweet.
Ever.
Congratulations.
Congratulations to all of them, including Tom Daley, who's won a medal for being adorable.
Oh.
So he's like knitting.
Maybe a little pouch for his gold medal.
That should be a category, knitting.
They should be. And he would also win that. So this is a message, an anonymous message that's being spread on the internet. And I thought it would be great to hear your thoughts on this. Here goes. Artists are not like athletes. We cannot win gold. We cannot beat other creatives. We cannot come first. A sport is objective. Our craft is subjective. Creating to be the best is a waste of energy. Instead, create to connect to the people who need you because they're out there. Create in your way because there's no right way. Take the pressure off and focus on your unique brand of magic.
Yes, agree. as a stand-up comedian, I remember being trolled on YouTube when I first started putting my comedy videos on YouTube, and I found out that this was this is what happens to a lot of women who have their video online. And in comedy, particularly specific to being told, "You're not funny, you're not funny." And what I realize is that it's all subjective. I'm not funny to you. I'm not talented to you. Got nothing from my show. That's you. It means nothing. It's how it's received. So it is true. And what I love about musicians and the band is that they work together to make a product, a beautiful gift. Not even, I shouldn't call it a product, but they work together to create a gift to the world. And as solo performers, we don't exactly have that. with other artists. But yeah, we really all share that mission. Mm. And there's no gold, unfortunately, but we would like some money.
Yes.
Amen, sister. Marga,
yes. What's your Cash App?
Yeah. really? Do you want to know?
give us all your Venmos.
Oh, okay, great. Well, my website is margagomez.com. I'd love to have people follow my YouTube channel. It's not quite where it ought to be, but
it's still 300 a gift away to the world.
I'm almost at 1,000. I'm 300 YouTube followers short of 1,000. I have a Buy Me a Coffee / Marga Gomez, which is really a fun. I don't know if you guys have that yet, but it's a really fun way to support someone. It's kind of like Patreon, but without, I don't know. It's fun to think you're buying somebody a cup of coffee, and sometimes people buy 10 cups of coffee, whatever, but it's kind of the same platform. So I'm putting solo coaching classes on that, one-on-one of an hour or 30 minutes or pick my brain. And I'm going to start offering other perks on my Buy Me a Coffee buymeacoffee.com/ Marga Gomez. So I think I'm just going to say that one, and people can get a perk or buy me a coffee.
Mm, what kind of coffee do you drink?
What coffee? Well, according to Marga in the morning, I drink Café Bustelo.
Ah, ding, ding, ding.
Brand names.
That's right.
But Café Bustelo is popular.
They're not Goya. Yeah.
It's, are you making like espresso or café con leche? Or what are you doing there? Is it like,
no, I just do, I just do a pour. Yeah. I usually, you know, I really don't care. It's a drug to me. Caffeine's a drug to me. So I just make a pot of coffee, and then I've got it for the week.
You don't have to deal with brewing anything.
I think coffee is, I don't know. Coffee's pretty amazing.
It is. Yeah. Amazing.
I'm a big fan. I mean,
I can't start the day without it.
I love talking about coffee. I like looking at coffee. I like smelling coffee.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, when you're Puerto Rican, it's like, what is breakfast?
Oh, I'm half Cuban, by the way, too. I don't want to leave that out.
Well, if you're Puerto Rican or Cuban, what is breakfast? Coffee. Toast.
Bread.
Mayorkas. Butter.
And butter.
Yes. You dip the toast, you dunk it into the coffee, right?
And it's made with what Americans know as French bread or pan de agua, you know. And fantastic. I could eat any toast, really.
I think we would just, you know, we didn't care.
Did your eyes ever grow up eating Mallorcas?
No, I don't. When you say that, I think of the Maja soaps I used to give my mom. I do have to leave, though. So have we done our goodbye closure?
We have to say goodbye for 20 minutes.
They're shutting everything down here in California. I've got to get.
Marga, thank you so much for coming on the show, darling. I love you.
Oh, that was so amazing. Wow, you're going to have to edit quite a bit.
I edit nothing.
Oh, no.
Take care, love.
The miniseries. Oh, I love you too so much. And from now on, no chicks.
For either
talk
of
to
us.
You soon. Yeah, see you online. Right.
Love
no
you,
chicks.
Darling.
Bye, just
darling.
Dicks for you, not me. Bye.
Marga Gomez lives in San Francisco, California. Mm. Check her out, margagomez.com. Mm. And go buy her a coffee.
Got some cafe con leche.
Yeah, with little tostadas, fresh squeezed orange juice if you got it.
Mm.
Mm. So, yeah, 3,000 shows coming up. We are inviting our favorite guests back onto the podcast.
Yes.
We are launching new podcasts.
Yes.
We are launching two new Cooking with Drag Queens episodes.
Yes.
And we're starting a whole new streaming series.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be live.
En vivo.
In living color, darling.
I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, Sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes the show happen. We wouldn't be able to talk to people like Margaret Gomez if it weren't for you and your ongoing support throughout these years. There's 16 years. This is our 17th season. And, you know, I really love what Margaret said, that performance is like a gift to the world, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like this podcast and the people that help make it, you know, are our collaborators, and you are giving a gift to the world for people to enjoy and to be able to understand what artists like Margaret Gomez, how they work, how they function, who they are as people.
And, go through the highs and lows of their careers. You know, it's like this woman has gone through extraordinary experiences. Mm-hmm. And here she is sharing that with you guys for almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
Giving generously of her time. Follow her on Facebook and, you know, Marga in the Morning. It's interesting, you know, because Marga really at her heart is a teacher, too. She's an amazing, you know, acting performance coach. And in a lot of ways, if you're sort of struggling, you know, finding your voice as an artist, it's good to sort of like tap into Marga's energy there to get mm-hmm. motivate you to reconnect with the world yourself. Mm-hmm. So check it out. Marga Gomez with an A at the at the end of Marga.
Mm-hmm.
Not Margo Channing.
I said Marga Gomez, but I've been saying her name like that all day. And she'd be like,
Marga Gomez.
I've been found out.
I know. I feel itchy and bitchy and scratchy. Calm and collected, but choking with panic, but alive. But alive! But alive! so many amazing guests coming this week to Feast of Fun. Subscribe to the Feast of Fun podcast wherever you find your favorite podcasts, and give us a review, give us a like, mm-hmm. follow us, interact. We depend on it, darling.
Yes.
Por favor.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.